Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks very, very much for joining us today. I just got off of a super fun conversation with Stephen Field about his new translation, his new book, The Duke of Zhou Changes, a study, an annotated translation of the Zhou'i. This came out with Horasowitz Verlag in 2015. Now, this is a really, really pleasurable book to read, whether or not you are particularly interested in early China or the texts of early China. So the intended audience of this book, and you'll hear a little bit about this in the moments to come, encompasses two very different, perhaps overlapping, but not necessarily so, kind of reader. One is the kind of reader who is a scholarly reader, who is interested in the particular history and textuality and texture of the Zhou'i, right? The Book of Zhou or the Duke of Zhou Changes. But another intended reader is a reader who wants to use this text for the purposes of divination, who might not know anything about early China, but will certainly learn something and learn why it's actually important to know something about the culture, society, politics of the context in which Stephen is arguing this text is derived from in order to actually use it for divination purposes. So there's lots of different kinds of readers who are going to be able to do different kinds of things with this text. And I'll add, it's also just a fabulously inspiring text to read through if you are at all interested in the possibilities of thinking with really beautiful and surprising juxtapositions of prose and poetry. So what the book does is it has three parts. The first part of the book give some context for understanding the history and origins of the text, and you'll hear a little in the moments to come about why that's actually important. So we talk a little bit in the conversation about some of the early history that informs what you'll read in the actual translations of the hexagrams, but we didn't have a chance to talk about some of the other really interesting texture that Stephen's bringing to the text in this introductory section, and that includes a detailed description of different forms of divination, including astrology, plastromancy, casting milfoil lots, ornithomancy, scapulomancy, etc. He also talks about the mythical origins of the text. He talks about kinds of diagrams and diagramming that are related to what we'll see in the text, and talks about also numbers and numeracy in terms of how we understand the nature and the origins of the Bagua. The book also, early on here, talks about the importance of the name of the text, what is changing in this idea of changes, and why is that important, why is that interesting, and also leads us through some of the most important commentaries to the text. So that's part one. Part two of the book translates the names, omen statements, and line texts of the 64 hexagrams. And most of our conversation actually focuses on that. So you'll actually hear some detailed descriptions of some examples, and it's really fascinating. Part three of the book offers concrete detailed instructions for casting the oracle using milfoil stocks, using coins, and interpreting the reading that results. And so there's a third part of the book that tells you, okay, let's say you are someone who wants to use this text for divination today, right now. How do you go about doing that? And it's a really, really thoughtful, actually, set of instructions for doing so. We also talk in the conversation to come about Stephen's work as a translator, as a really accomplished and quite thoughtful translator. But what I want to do before I leave you to that is just give you a very brief sense of what I mean when I say this is a super inspiring book to read through, to flip through, if you're interested in the possibilities of, and really the creative and generative possibilities of reading kind of poetic, musical, odd juxtaposition. So here, if this is just a random page I flipped to, page 144, this is hexagram 29, Khan, the pit. And I'm just going to read down the column of omens here from 0 to 6, and you'll hear Stephen talking about what omens are in the context of this in a moment, but I'm just going to read this through as a text, and you'll see what I mean. There is a capture. Pit within a pit. He plunges down the pitfall. The pit has a drop. Bring him here. and thump him down. Steep and deep, he plunges down the pitfall. A flask of wine, tureens, a pair, in earthenware, handed through the window, bound. The pit is not filled, though all around is level. Tie him up with braids and cords, throw him into a thorny keep. Okay, so if you are reading this for the purpose of understanding it from a scholarly perspective or using it for the purpose of divination, what you would do is work these individual omens into a larger practice of understanding the counsel that came from them and then the fortune that resulted. And there's lots of apparatus that Stephen's given us to help us do that. But I think even from the perspective of just reading something beautiful, even if you just flip through these and read down this, it's just completely awesome. And I could just do this for hours and hours, and I won't, because I want you to get to the interview itself. So please do, if you have a chance, to get your hands on a copy and flip through. All of the hexagrams are inspiring like that in different ways. And I just really enjoyed reading through this book. Okay, so with that, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks very, very much for listening and for the support of the channel that listening constitutes. I'm here today to talk with Stephen Field about his new book, The Duke of Zhou Changes. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Stephen. And thanks very much both for writing a really, really cool book and doing a really cool translation for us, and also for making time to talk with me about it today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Carla. I appreciate the opportunity, and I am very impressed with the interviews I've listened to yours before.
Well, thank you. So let's create another one that I'm sure will be equally awesome. And let's start at the beginning. Stephen, can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the field? How did you come to work on China studies specifically?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of an old guy. I actually started studying Chinese the year after Richard Nixon went to China. But I just chose the language as my foreign language requirement for college. But once I started the language, everything changed. When I graduated with actually a degree in English literature, my best friend, as a graduation present, gave me two books. One was the complete poetry of Chairman Mao. The other one was the James Legge translation of the Book of Changes.
Oh, wow.
And so since I had a summer to devote to reading, I read both of those books from cover to cover. And one of them, I decided that I was going to learn it well enough that I could read it in Chinese someday. Of course, that's the Book of Changes. So,
of course, that's the poetry of Mao, right? I mean, right. Inspiring, earth-shattering beauty.
Yeah, that's probably a value judgment.
So that actually takes us really nicely into what I was going to ask you next. But now I'm just going to ask you something before we get to that.
Okay.
And that is, for listeners who may not be familiar with your research trajectory, with what brought you here, what are you typically working on when you're not working on translating the Duke of Zhou Changes? Sort of what kind of broad research interests brought you to an interest in this text?
Yeah, so my bachelor's degree was in English literature, and my PhD was in comparative literature. So my first love is poetry. So my first book was also a translation. It was a translation of one of the most difficult poems in the Chinese language. The poem is called Tian Wen, The Heaven Questions, from the second great poetry anthology, the Chu Ci. And so that poem was actually a part of a graduate course, and I did a little bit of it for the course. And the professor said, look, you should really do the whole book. I think I know a publisher. It just so happened it was New Directions in New York. So one of the best publishers of poetry in the history of America. And so it kind of made my name. I had always translated. It's for whatever reason, it's something that has always appealed to me. And so my first and third books have been translations. So that's really how I'm better known. Poetry is still my major love. I am a poet. I don't write a lot of poetry, but I still do. I've never stopped writing poetry since I was a child. And of course, Book of Changes has lots of poetry.
Yes.
So.
So when you're writing poetry, are you making that available for us? Is that sort of, tell me about how, so now I just want to hear all about this. then we'll get to the book. So in terms of navigating how you think about yourself as a poet, as a translator, as a writer scholar, how, I'm just going to leave this open for you.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I did write one long poem. It's about 40 pages long that was published in a journal in London. And then that kind of gave me a certain name in certain circles for this reason. It was an attempt to write the Chinese epic. Of course, most people are aware that China doesn't have an epic in the Western sense of the term, yet there's all kinds of epical works, but no epic poem. So I took the myth and legend of ancient China and kind of weaved it into a long poem. That poem actually was picked up not too long ago by the author of this series of books on ecology and religion, Yale and Harvard. This particular book was Taoism and Ecology, and they took that poem as the prologue for their whole book because it apparently, I actually never would have thought this, gave readers a ecological view of the creation or the origin of the Chinese world.
That's awesome. And hopefully what we can do is if you send me some kind of link to that, we can make that available on for this so that listeners can read it as well. So this is fascinating in all kinds of ways. And I already have a sense that I'm going to want to be talking to you for hours and hours. So let's get to the book itself. Okay, so the book that we're talking about today is The Duke of Zhou Changes, A Study and Annotated Translation of the Zhou'i. Now, you've already talked a little bit about what brought you to the Book of Changes initially, right? And you said, I'm going to be doing a translation of this. But how did you come to this particular project, deciding to do a translation now at this moment in your life? So can you talk a little bit about how you, you know, how you came to this project and came to commit to a translation of a really fascinating and I think really, really difficult work? What brought you to that decision?
Well, this is going to make you laugh.
A lot of things make me laugh. That's surprising.
I'm not sure what the listeners are going to think about this. A couple of my scholarly friends know this, but it's a great revelation. I have been working on feng shui for maybe 15 or 20 years, and so I have a certain name in feng shui circles, both popular and scholarly. Okay. And I was approached at one point by an author and a publisher and asked if I would create a translation of the Book of Changes for the Complete Idiot's Guide.
Wow.
Which I did.
Wow.
And they said it wasn't idiot enough. Okay. In other words, it was too difficult for the public.
Wow.
So I actually did that transition over a space of about a year and a half. And that's what got me started. I learned over the years that a book of the magnitude of the I Ching is really, it's a lifetime project. And I probably never would have had the guts to really just sit out and do a translation had I not been given this opportunity. So that actually became kind of the first attempt. And that was like 15 years ago, something like that. And so I just let it sit and gestate for 5 years. And then I finally went back to it and began to do a scholarly translation. So that's how it got started. So aren't you glad you asked that question?
I am so glad that I asked that question. I am so glad I asked. So tell us a little bit about, and I... asking you this not because it's not clear from the book, because you talk about this in the book, but for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to get their hands and eyes and brain cells on the book, who's the kind of audience for this book? When you imagine someone, your ideal reader, picking this up and working with it and using it and developing a relationship with it, who is that kind of person and what kind of relationship is that?
Right. So, although this is not the first translation that attempts to retrieve something like an urtext of the Book of Changes, it is one that uses that goal as its priority. I have attempted to the best of my ability to not utilize any meanings of vocabulary that are post-Confucian. So basically, the rule of thumb is to utilize texts like the Shijing Book of Odes, Shang Shu Book of Documents, and that type of text to try to interpret vocabulary in this book. Of course, most translations, I would say the great majority of translations, don't do that. So, for example, the Han Dynasty Dictionary, Shu Wen Jieze, is the basis for a lot of meanings for most translators. But that book didn't come out until 100 AD, and that's, you know, 1,000 years after the book was written. So the whole point is here, I try to find that urtext, which is very difficult, and in many cases impossible. And so that's why scholars tend to leave this book alone. Because you have to make some judgments along the line based on either your knowledge or sometimes perhaps even a bit of a guess. Because if the first priority is to uncover the urtext, the second priority is to make this understandable. Now, that second priority is sometimes the most difficult. And if you look at other scholarly translations of this book, especially ones that attempt to uncover something like the original text, you will find that many of the passages make no sense at all. In other words, that is not their priority. Their priority is just to translate the words of the sentences as literal as possible and then just see what comes out. But since my perceived audience for this book is not just the scholarly world, it's also the general public, I have to make it understandable. And so I think when the reviews of this book start coming out, that's one thing that will probably be mentioned, is that you actually could sit down, like you did, Carla, mm-hmm. and read this book from cover to cover, or at least from hexagram 1 to hexagram 64, mm-hmm. and find that there are narratives in there, mm-hmm. and that you actually can pull out a lot of ancient history and such just by reading those texts. You can't do that with many of the translations of this book. So I guess I have already heard from a lot of the people in the reading public, especially through Facebook, because there's a as anyone who knows anything about this book knows, this is a cult classic.
Right.
Especially since the 60s with Wilhelm's translation into English. And so there's a reading public out there. I suppose if I had published this with a popular press, I could have made a lot of money off of it. But that's not the point. It's a scholarly press, and I don't get any royalties at all.
I remember growing up, one of the only books I remember in our house, and there were lots of books in our house, but I have a very vivid memory of, along with The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings trilogy, my mom kept a copy of what she called the I Ching, I think,
right.
and
right.
had pennies and would tell me about how she would, you know, do things with it. And this is before I knew anything about China or anything like that. So I have I had a connection with that aspect of your translation that was very much, you know, take me back to the basement in my childhood, kind of remember the carpet and thing. So there's all kinds of stuff that we need to talk about that you've brought up, right? But what I want to do is just ask you to talk a little bit about something that you just mentioned a little while ago. So you talked about one of your goals being recovering the urtext.
Right.
So it's not necessarily self-evident that would necessarily be a goal of a translator of this work, right? So can you say a little bit more about why that is important to you? Sort of why, as a translator and reader and engager with this text, is it important for you to translate in such a way and to read in such a way that you're recovering an Ur text? Like, where does that come from for you?
Well, so the text of the Zhou Yi Ur I Ching over the centuries has accumulated a large body of commentary, the most important of which are called the Confucian commentaries, which basically came in the Han Dynasty or the late Warring States period. These commentaries attempt to dissect a cosmology or a pseudo a proto-philosophy out of this book, since it was so venerated by all of the officials of the early Zhou Dynasty. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. This book was clearly written before the golden age of Chinese thought. And although I'm not a philosopher or a sociologist, I feel sure that that period where this book originates, you know, 1000 BC, there was no philosophy. And so if a book was written at that time, it was not written for what we normally think philosophy is for, self-reflection and such. It was written for divination. So that has to be the priority. So there are many images or omens from that era that diviners would then utilize to represent divinatory contexts or whatever, but you cannot lose sight of the original intent of this book. So that's what I try to do. Now, it's very difficult. As I mentioned to you before, when we were chatting before the interview began, my translation does divide each line of the hexagram judgment or the line text into its component parts based on their function, omen, counsel or injunction, and fortune. There's a pretty clear cause and effect relation between those. So once the omen is determined, then some wise counsel tries to interpret it and give advice to the person seeking guidance. And then if they follow that advice, there will be some fortune, good or bad. It's not always easy to find that cause and effect, but I tried my best to do so.
Well, it's actually kind of perfect to segue in. So as a little bit of context for listeners, early in the preface, you take us through a brief history of previous translators and translations of the work. And you talk about, as you've just mentioned, the ways that this translation and the kind of work that this translation does importantly differs from what's come before. Now, you just mentioned that one of the innovations here, and I think it's a really important innovation, is the dividing of these texts into the functional components. So maybe this is a good opportunity for listeners who are like, what are you talking about? Functional components, omen, like, I think that sounds really cool, but like, I don't have the book in front of me, so what the hell? Maybe this is a good opportunity to perhaps anatomize one of the hexagrams, right? What if we kind of go into an example and use that as a way to maybe pull out for listeners what's going on? You know, what are these components? What are they meant to do? And you can kind of talk us through how you envision us using one of these. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, so let me give a little bit of a preface first about how these functions perhaps originated. I am borrowing from the work of probably the greatest American scholar of the Eugene, Edward Shaughnessy, at the University of Chicago, who in an article in early China years ago in the 90s tried to utilize the records of oracle bone divination in the Zuo Zhuan, the commentary of the Spring on Annals, to project how the text of the I Ching were derived. And so that was really my inspiration. So, for example, if it were an oracle bone that you're cracking instead of casting the stalks of the yarrow plant, you first ask a question, perhaps. You crack the bone, and then the diviner, by looking at that crack, then however the diviner does it, then comes up with a line of poetry, an omen statement that perhaps was inspired by that crack, or maybe it was a manual that he had that related to the form of the crack, the structure of the crack, or whatever. We just don't know. And that probably was the origin of these so-called omens in the Book of Changes. And then in some of these wonderful records in the Zhuozhuan, after the diviner reads the crack and comes up with this oracular verse, then someone invariably asks, what does that mean? And then someone else from the realm, perhaps it's the king, or perhaps it's the mother of the king, will then say, well, that means this. If you do this, this will happen. Okay. And that's really the origin of this council or injunction. And then in the Zhuozhuan, again, invariably, the story will continue with the result. Did the person divining follow the advice? Listen to the council? And if so, what happened? And then you have the result of good or bad fortune. So that's very likely how the Book of Changes came about, too. What we don't have, though, is the crack to read. Instead, we have these wonderful images. So this concept of imagery, the word is xiang in Chinese, in classical Chinese, which of course is the same character for the elephant or the ivory of the elephant, which was carved into representations. That's where this idea of image came from. In the Book of Changes, it's that omen text, which for whatever reason represents somehow the moment of divination for the diviner. And then, depending on how this book was actually recorded, someone then will interpret that and then give it some kind of prognostication for fortune. We don't know, and probably never will know, how this actually happened. But that it did is almost impossible to deny. And so you can follow some of these throughout the book. I guess the example that is most famous is the one that Ed Shaughnessy mentioned in that article from the 90s, from Hexagram 53, which the title of the hexagram is Progression. It really shows a succeeding images of a wild goose moving from a lower to a higher location on this property, and one of the councils from one of those omens mentions something about a husband going to war, and also it's time to defend against bandits. Okay, so what is the connection between those two? Well, it's pretty well known in poetic imagery in ancient China that geese mated for life. So if there is a goose flying alone, it means that it's lost its mate. And so that's the connection, because when the husband goes off to war, he's leaving his mate behind. Okay, so these are the little connections that are there if you can find them. And so that's what I try to do. This particular hexagram, the fortune that is related to that council is there will be misfortune, which probably means the husband will not come back. So I've already had some online commentary on my translation by actual diviners. Especially in Europe, the I Ching is very widely used for divination in Europe, who have pointed out some of those areas in the book where that cause and effect relationship breaks down. You know, if I'd have had twice the amount of room to work with in this book, I would have loved to express why I could not make that that work. But that is how it works.
Mm-hmm. And this is for listeners who are following along. This is a hexagram that begins on page 214 of the book. And this page, I mean, you can really see in the language of this particular, just this page, right? 53 with the omens and the council and the fortune. This poetic sense of the language just emerges out of the page too. And as we kind of work our way through, not only is the wild goose progressing to high land, the husband goes to war and will not return. The wife is pregnant but will not give birth, right? Now's the time to defend against bandits. And you just said that. They're also eating and drinking, cronk, cronk. And I love onomatopoeia, so I needed to, you know, say that. Perhaps you'll get your roof beams, right, as part of the council. The last council here in the sixth line, its feathers can be used in the dance. So it's just amazing. Even just on one page here, there's just so much. Whether you are exploring it as a kind of landscape right here, or whether you're actually, as the book is, as you say, right, frequently the book is intended to do, using this for divination. And the third part of the book gives really detailed explanations for how one might do that, right? Either using milfoil stalks, and there's very detailed descriptions for how to do that, how to cast the milfoil, or using coins, right? So you've already heard some feedback from people who are starting to do this.
Yes.
Okay. So this is one of the things that's really striking to me, too, and I just want to mention this to listeners, and then we can kind of move on, is there's the translation and your apparatus here around the translation really takes these divinatory practices very seriously. And really what I mean by that is you even give us a sense of the kinds of questions and the structure of the kinds of questions that will be particularly useful for divining with this text and the kinds of questions that won't be, right? So don't ask yes or no questions. Ask other kinds of questions for which there's a substantive answer and you can work your way through this. And I think that's just, I really like that about it. I really appreciated that aspect of the translation.
Right. So the translation itself, if you just take those hexagram tables, so someone who has the book in front of them would be able to do a thumb through the book and find that every hexagram occupies one whole page in a nice big square table. Those hexagram tables translate the original line text, hexagram and line texts. Those are as literal as I can possibly get based on those assumptions or presumptions I made before. And that's what scholars will be interested in. Mm-hmm. The commentaries that I attach, these commentaries is probably what scholars will have a problem with, because that's where I try to interpret. And I interpret, again, based on this Ur version, a version written by the founder of the Zhou dynasty and one of his sons, which is why, of course, I named the book The Duke of Zhou Changes. That also will probably irk a few readers in the scholarly world. I'm certainly making a judgment there. But those commentaries then try to interpret the text based on the era of the presumed authorship. That's what will be most useful to the modern diviner, because these texts are so old. I mean, we're talking about a 2,000-year-old, 3,000-year-old text here. Just the text itself would be pretty much indecipherable. So for the modern reader, there needs to be some context. So you have the text in the translation and then the context in the commentary. And so, again, that's what these modern diviners from Europe are loving, because I'm speaking to them as as a fellow diviner there, in a sense. But the hexagram table is clearly from the point of view of the modern scholar of I Ching.
It's really interesting hearing you talking about divining and your interest in divining, because you can sort of, you know, thinking back to your initial comments about your work as a poet, right, and the kind of poetry that you've done, at least the little part of it that you've shared descriptions of with us, it sounds like it's very interested in creation, right, and origin, some sort of time travel. And so it actually makes perfect sense, right, that sort of an interest in divination, sort of looking toward possible futures and looking back toward imagined pasts would be part of the same fabric of interest that you bring to all these projects. So
exactly. Actually,
yeah, it's pretty cool to think about that. Now, you've just talked about the fact that, and you mentioned this in the book accepts the account and proceeds from there, that King Wen and his son, the Duke of Zhou, were the original authors of the Zhou-Yi.
Right.
And one of the really interesting things that the book does in its prefatory or introductory apparatus before we get to the hexagram texts is give us a little bit of background for understanding the context that this text would have been used in as an or text, right? In divinatory context. And this is really interesting because it's not just, and as listeners who become readers work through the hexagrams and read through the text, I think it'll become really clear that this isn't just a matter of, oh, this is useful context, and then we'll just proceed from there because historical context is self-evidently useful. It's not that at all. It's that it's really, really important and interesting.
Yes.
And relevant, right? So let's talk a little bit about this early Chinese context and maybe open up some of what you talk about here in the book.
So it's interesting. You know, there are a couple of predecessors to the Book of Changes as books of divination. One called the Guicang. The Guicang, for years, existed only in fragments. But a version was found in a tomb maybe 15 years ago, and we finally have an idea of what the predecessor to the Book of Changes looked like. And one thing that is very striking about the difference between these two versions of divination texts, even though they have the same hexagrams, the same number of hexagrams, pretty much the same hexagram names, the texts are completely different. The texts of the predecessor, the Guicang, are full of mythology. You see all of these mythical gods, demigods, heroes being referred to as if they were living in the age of that divination. But the Book of Changes is opposite. There's very little, or apparently very little, mythology there, very little magic. But that's, I say apparently, because it's there. It's just hard to find. And that's, again, one of the things I've tried to point out. So that introductory section where I take the clan that eventually founded the Zhou Dynasty and trace them back to their earliest clan hero, Hoji, Lord Millet, and then follow the heroes of the clan in their exodus across Western China and their great wars and battles and such. Of course, that's very hard to do. There's so little to utilize to create these histories. But it's necessary because I think a lot of those heroes are referred to in the book. And so that's where you will see in the commentary section me saying, perhaps this relates to the exodus of Gong Liu when he left and traveled over the mountains to get to the homeland of the Zhou. Things like that. If I had not prefaced the book, then those stories would have no depth whatsoever. But if someone knows those stories, then they will give so much more depth and value to these short little narrations that I think are embodied in these hexagram texts.
That's right. And so just to give listeners kind of a little sense of the flavor of this, and then I'd like to ask you a question to open it back up again. There's a short history of ancient China or the ancient Chinese right at the beginning of the book. And it takes us, I mean, this is not your dry, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue kind of history at all. We meet in the context of Shang culture, we meet Zhou Xin, who begins, as you tell us here, as this wise prince who turns to self-indulgence and this really visceral kind of violent behavior. At one point, he punishes a particular individual, Lord Chang, the ruler of the House of Ji, for sighing over some of that violence, right? So I just imagine, you know, he gets punished for sighing over this really violent, like cut people's limbs off and like, you know, feed their flesh to people. And so this is relevant in part. This is not, and I say this just to give listeners a sense of the relevance to the text. This is relevant in part because this Lord Chang, right, who gets punished for sighing over this really graphic violence is supposed to have written the earliest layer of the Zhou'i. So at every point along the way, the story of this these people, these figures, that sometimes this mythology, sometimes not, right, is really woven into a story of the past and the possible origins of this text. You also talk about, in this part of the text, the early Zhou and the Duke of Zhou, who also added lines to the Zhou'i. So I'm not going to ask you to reiterate, right, that like everything that's here in the introduction, that's unreasonable, and listeners will find that here in the book when they get a copy for themselves. But there's a lot in the text that actually, as you've just mentioned, benefits from and depends on some sense of the society and culture of early China, and that includes anything from war to marriage, love, human sacrifice. There's a lot of really interesting texture that comes up in the texts of all the hexagrams. So for you, are there any particularly big, important contextual things or small, important contextual things that listeners need to know about this world of early China in order to understand the text and the use of the text for divination today? Is there any, and I'm not, you know, asking you to give kind of a comprehensive account, but is there anything that you might want to flag for listeners who then will get a copy of the book and look for themselves?
Well, there are obviously a few things of great importance. I can mention a couple. For one thing, since my priority is to try to recover the divinatory context of this text, I think, and I'm not alone in this, but I'm the one who will probably popularize this view, I think that there are individual hexagrams that actually depict divining. So my favorite is a hexagram which I translate as the jawbone. That's hexagram 27. No one has really been able to figure out what this means. There's all kinds of versions of it. But if you think of it as using the jawbone as the actual bone used to crack to derive an oracle, then it makes total sense. And with that understanding, if you look at every character in that hexagram, you will find that there actually are some technical words in there that pertain very specifically to cracking bones for divination. And these kind of things have never been pointed out before. And so I think once you, first of all, attempt to recover this meaning from this particular hexagram and then locate this technical language that, of course, can mean other things too. You put it all together and it makes it pretty clear that's what the text mean. So this particular hexagram actually shows someone, it's almost like a couple of diviners talking about the bones they use for divining. And so one diviner says, look at my jawbone, that's the perfect tool for divination. You really should put aside those turtles that you've been using and look at my jawbones. And this diviner would probably say something like, well, okay, tell me how it works. Well, first you turn this jawbone upside down and then you touch the firebrand to the crown. See, there's a poem there. It's talking about actually divining with this bone. And then it goes on and just continues through the divination ritual. Every one of these then becomes an omen for a council that has a fortune or prognostication based on it. So when I located those technical terms, I actually was able to put myself back into that context as if I were watching these old diviners there talking about their trade. And there's a couple of other hexagrams that do similar things. Another one is it's hexagram 60, which is called Jia. Well, Jia really is it just means the a joint of bamboo. But plants like yarrow or milfoil have these joints, and these are the tools of the milfoil divination rite. So this particular text is probably talking about divining by milfoil. Now, rather than what we think of as divination by milfoil, where the stalks are manipulated in order to derive a random number, what you see in this particular hexagram is something more like traditional Chinese medicine. So these nodes of milfoil or nodes of some kind of plant have tastes. Mm-hmm. And it's well known that yarrow was a medicinal a plant. It's even, I think, a medicinal plant in Native America. And so bitterness and sweetness then have some context. We're not quite sure what it is, but you have to look at the hexagram as it is presented to try to determine what that context is. And there's more. In fact, just by mentioning a TCM, mm-hmm. one of the most difficult hexagrams in the entire book, which just about every translator that you will find has a different translation. In fact, when I would listen to your interview with Richard Smith Rice, I think he actually mentioned that one himself. The hexagram is number 52, Gun. This character, Gun, really is hard to interpret. And I guess that explains why everyone translates it differently. But if you look at all six lines of this hexagram, you will see that every line has a different body part. So you have the back, the feet, the legs, the waist, the belly, the jaw. And it's the same story with this hexagram as with the one about the jaw bones. There is technical information in there that has been hidden all of these years. And it actually has something to do with kind of mock Sebastian or perhaps even acupuncture or acupressure. I know that some people will think that's a bit iconoclastic mentioning TCM in such an ancient text, but you have this technical information there about the fuming of the heart. And so, see, people try to translate that as smoking the heart, you know, like, so you capture someone in a battle and you sacrifice them and you smoke their hearts. Well, okay, that makes good sense, but it makes a lot more sense if you translate this gun as a type of obstruction. In fact, the earliest commentary of this book, this unfortunately gets to the post-Confucian Ten Wings, mm-hmm. Glosses that character Gun as Jir, to stop. And that actually is what it means. But it's not to stop as if you are involved in some kind of process and you stop doing something. It's stoppage. It's obturation. This is, anyone familiar with TCM will understand this. It's where the chi in your system gets clogged. Mm-hmm. And so what you have here is each one of these situations is stoppage or obstruction of chi in these particular parts of the body. Okay, so a lot of people will say, no way. You know, that TCM didn't exist back then. Well, are you sure?
And you know, and we can talk about medicine and the engagement between the body and sort of the illnesses of the body and obstructions in the body without even needing to call it TCM, right? We can just call it sort of medicine and healing. And I think it's pretty interesting and compelling here to read it that way. So this is 52. And really, also, as we're talking about this, and we're going to get to translation in a moment, so we don't completely leave that aside. But I just want to mention also, I'll ask you, have you ever done, or has anyone ever done with this translation, any kind of sort of performance or readings? Because even if you just read through the omens, right? Even if you just read down any of the columns, and like for jawbones on 139, eye the mandible to see for yourself what the mouth has to say. Discard your sacred turtles. Behold my racks of mandibles. Then we have to turn the jawbone upside down, touch the mandible. The tiger's gaze is piercing its prey so far away. Touch the firebrand, follow the mandible. I mean, there's something really inspiring and just fascinating about this as a text that jumps off the page and asks you to create relationships here.
Yes.
So yeah, I could see this being the basis of a really fabulous performance of this text, a kind of creative performance. So maybe if you haven't already done that, you might think about doing that, because I think it would be amazing.
So at one point in my life, I actually decided that I would create a poem for each hexagram that was inspired by the text of the hexagram.
Really?
And I have a few of those, that have never been published. It's, I've got this large folio of poems that no one has ever seen.
Oh, you should make those. Have you, I don't know if you've, and then we'll get to the translation, but I recently had a chance to talk with Will Buckingham, who's a scholar and a writer as well, who wrote a whole cycle of short stories about the I Ching.
Wow.
So if you haven't, I should just get the two of you in a room and just have you write things together. But yeah, make those, that would be awesome to see. I can totally see how you would get that from here too.
Yeah, well, so that's true, and thank you for bringing that up, because these texts of the hexagram are very, very poetic, and of course I really did attempt to make these lines sing. So when I would translate something, I would read it aloud.
That's right. Sorry, that's super clear.
Yeah.
That's super clear. I mean, that these translations, harping on this, but it's really striking. I mean, these translations, these English renderings, are very much the product of somebody who has an eye and an ear for the musicality of language. Like, it's, there's no doubt about that. And that's one of the things that's so fascinating about reading this. Okay, so translation. I'm going to have to let you go in like 10 minutes. So before that, we should actually talk about translation, since this is something that you opened with, and that's very much an important contribution of this. Okay, so you're obviously a really thoughtful and extraordinarily experienced translator. So let's just kind of open things up and talk a little bit about that aspect of your craft. And maybe I'll just start kind of in general. Are there any moments of or aspects of the text that you found particularly interesting, either because they were especially challenging for you, or they were especially inspiring for you, or just created problems that were good to chew on from the perspective of your craft as a translator?
Well, sure. There's one particular character that appears in three different hexagrams that it doesn't get overlooked, but most translators don't seem to understand the importance of that particular character. The character is Ming. It's the bird meow with the mouth radical. And that character Ming means the chirping of a bird, or the call of an animal of some kind. And when you find it in a text this old, the chances are very high that it is indeed an animal that is chirping. But most translators, because the thing that is supposedly chirping is indecipherable, then do not translate it in its literal sense. And so, for example, one hexagram, which I translate as the elephant.
Right, it's 16 on page 107.
Right, so this character, Yu, if you look at it, it has the elephant pictograph on the right, and then the euphonetic on the left. And in most contexts, that character doesn't mean something like enthusiasm or joy or something like that. And so the translators, the traditional translators like Wilhelm and such, translate it as something like expressions of enthusiasm. So that mean you, or proclaiming joy. But I do believe that it means an elephant. Now, you know, in the era that this book was produced, the Chinese language, of course, was not standardized at all. So there's all kinds of instances of characters losing their meaning, the meanings are forgotten, or different variants were used. And so the new variant perhaps had a different shade of meaning, so that became the standard meaning, whatever. That may be what happened here. But if you look at it as an elephant, then all the lines make perfect sense. But you have to think of it in that sense. So the first line, the one that uses the Ming, Mingyu then would be a trumpeting elephant. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's a beautiful image. What most people don't know, certainly moderns, is that China... ancient China was covered with elephants. I mean, the elephants came all the way up to the Yellow River. But especially south of the Yellow River, elephants were used in farming and such. And one of the great sage heroes of China, Sage King Shun, supposedly farmed in the wilds with elephants. And so I particularly think this hexagram is about an elephant. And then the subtext is Shun out there using this elephant to farm. And so he has to wall it off with rocks when it gets belligerent or whatever. And
not all day long.
Right. and you tell me why that is the case. the point is, yes, anyone can translate it as elephant, but what I tried to do is supply that subtext of Sage King Shun. And there are various records of him when he was discovered by Sage King Yao out in the wilderness. He was actually farming, basically breaking out the wilderness using an elephant, which makes perfect sense. Elephants can just tear trees down. In that last line, elephant in the dark, it's probably putting some kind of blinders on the elephant like you would with horses and mules. Hard to say, but it all makes sense. Whereas when you talk about enthusiasm, that's a little harder. I mean, even on that line 3 where I call it a wistful element, I've actually found a text which talks about, the emotional quality of elephants, just like we think of our pets as having emotions. And so I can call it the wistful elephant. I mean, so that's just one example. There are a couple of other examples. I don't know if we have time here. I can mention
those. Yeah, take us to at least one other.
Okay, so this other example is hexagram 15, which is pronounced Qin. It's the same story. The second line of this hexagram is Ming Qin. The calling Qin. Well, what in the world is Qin? The Qin with the word radical means modesty. And a lot of translators like myself who try to search for this original meaning look for variant characters with that same Qin phonetic. So there's one of them with the mouth radical, which is some kind of rodent, like a hamster or something like that. There's another one with the rat radical. Which definitely is some kind of rodent. But there's another one with the bird radical. And this goes back to my mention earlier about the kind of hidden mythology in this book. There's a famous bird called the Jin bird, which only had one wing. Hmm. And before the Jin bird could fly, it had to have a mate. And so they would join, and then they could fly with these two wings. And so it's the same story. If you look at the lines with that in mind, for example, the first line is just the doubled character. And so, for example, I think Wilhelm translates this one, modesty about his modesty. Again, pretty pretty absurd. But that particular phrase actually appears in a pre-Confucian text where it is used as a gloss on this bird called the bi-niao, the wedwing bird. That's my translation of it. Bi-niao, the e is wing. Now, of course, it's bird. The b is to join. So it's the bird with joined wings. And so this jian jian or qian qian was a gloss on that. And so it probably means they joined and flew off. So I translate it as taking wing, because they joined and therefore they had the ability to take wing. And then line two is the calling wedwing. Line three, the twirling wedwing. Well, it must be pretty difficult. Can you imagine how difficult it is to join those two bodies and fly off? So that's the character lao, meaning twirling. And then line four, very interesting. This character hui doesn't really appear except in this one instance in early texts. The earliest gloss on it meant to split. Mm-hmm. And so that's obviously, from my perspective, what it means here. The birds split apart, which means they cannot fly anymore. Now, I'm not going through the council and the prognostication, but if you follow all of those, you will see that there are relatable results from what these actions are. So again, trying to keep my mind in a pre-Confucian worldview, certainly thinking mythically, this came about. Now, I have learned in the meantime that one other commentator made that suggestion, so I'm certainly not the only one that thinks this, which is great.
And this makes me also know that when they open the book and they go to an individual hexagram, like this one on that starts on page 104 and goes to 105 and 106, there is detailed commentary that you've provided to us that explains these readings. So it's not just these boxes where you'll see, you know, taking wing, but you can go to line one and read the explanation for this and see the Chinese characters that you're using. And so there's a lot of apparatus here that can help readers who are, you know, maybe not using this for divination, but reading to try to understand how you are interpreting this, to sort of go there with you.
Yes.
So, Stephen, there are a million billion things that I would like to ask you. I would love to go through all of these hexagrams. I think it's clear. I think it's totally beautiful and a really wonderful contribution to the field. It's also a super pleasurable book to read through. But unfortunately, we've come to our conclusion. Hopefully listeners will get a sense. We'll use this as an opportunity to pick up the book for themselves and see all of the wonders in there that we didn't have a chance to talk about. And there are lots. And so this is my time to ask you, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention, talk about, or even flag for listeners?
Well, just one very minor thing. The Chinese text is included for every hexagram. It would have been wonderful if I'd have had room in those hexagram tables to make it all one on one page. But unfortunately, there was not enough room for that. But it's oftentimes just on the opposite page or just a page later. So anyone who knows Chinese can compare the translation with the original Chinese. And this, of course, scholars would require. I wish, so since this is indeed a scholarly press, I do give as many references as I possibly can for people to look up different passages that I use to interpret the text. So please do realize that this book can enhance your scholarship of this text.
Definitely. And so now that the translation is out, and congratulations on the book, what are you working on now? What's currently animating you and inspiring you?
Well, I will never cease to be exhilarated by anything dealing with ancient divination, be it in China or the West. So I am writing an article currently on fate and Warring States texts, specifically the Zuo Zhuan. And there is one passage that I'm I'm stuck on. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but it's the first passage to put the concept of xiang, image, and shu, number, together. And of course, these two terms represent the two earliest forms of divination in China, the image of the crack and the number representing the count of the millfold stocks. So these terms are related in this passage, and I'm trying to understand the relationship. I actually have given this at a conference, and it just went over most people's heads, and so I didn't get a whole lot of feedback on it. But I'm almost finished with it. I'll be submitting it this year.
Great. Well, thanks for taking time out of that to talk with me today. And thank you so much. I hope it's completely obvious. It's been a total pleasure. I think the book is awesome. And congratulations. And thank you for making the time.
Well, thank you, Carla. It's been a real joy to talk with you. And I hope I get to meet you someday in the flesh.
Great. You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.